Hey, and welcome back to another Magnus and Marcus on Coaching. I'm Steve Magnus, joined by my good friend and colleague, John Marcus. We're going to dive right into this week's episode, which is It's All About the Shoes. So these shoe things.
Shoe tech. It's shoe tech, I think you have to call it. It's because it's powerful. It's like the iPhone, man. It's or iPod, or it's tech. It's amazing.
It is tech, you know. The interesting thing on this is that every other sport has dealt with something like this, but track is like so basic, old school, etc. that we never... Well, I take that back. We have, with like the brush spikes in the 1960s, you know. But we haven't really recently.
No. Because again, it's... Running is very simple. It's very hard to, you know, change people's minds. But runners are like any other athlete. They want performance and they want progress and they want to go as fast and as, you know, quick as they can. And you offer a piece of tech that says you're still running technically, and you are. There's no doubt about it. Like, we're not saying, oh, all of a sudden you're on rollerblades here. But that can have such a potent impact, that is game-changing and pretty astonishing and amazing.
So let's break this down, because I think, you know, in this podcast, what we're hoping to do is add some nuance and clarity to, like, what the big deal is. Because I think in this whole debate, things get lost. You know, I know you tweeted some things out, John. I tweeted some things out, and I saw your post about having all of Kenya attack you. And
yes, the citizenry of Kenya that came out. And time out, just, I love Kenyans. I've coached Kenyans. They're amazing people, but they're very literal people. Yes. And when it went viral in Kenya, it was a literalness, and the nuance that the tweet had escaped their cultural frame of reference. And so they took it as, I literally thought Kipchoge just sucked. No, he is the GOAT. There is no questions about that, hands down. But he's human, and his physiology didn't change in the last couple of years as he got older. He was, you know... Then the marathon's a weird nut too, because we don't have a standard regulation surface and distance, a repeatable distance that we go on, like the track. So you can cross compare track times anywhere in the world. Sure, there's differences in elevation and, you know, weather, but it's a standard regulation. The basketball court, NBA basketball court, standard regulation, NFL football court or football field, 100 yards. The marathon, it's always been a world's best, because we've gravitated towards a course, kind of like cross country, that is the most conducive to running quickly. And then we've anchored, like all humans do, our perception about what's good or what's high status based on the scarcity of marks or the scarcity of number of people who can hit a certain threshold of different marks, and 2 hours being that esteemed barrier. So then you all of a sudden optimize like crazy and take someone who is reaching the threshold and limits of human physiology on a Berlin type course, which is about, you know, Steve and I ballpark it 204, 203 high. Like, we were hitting the ceiling with a lot of our best runners in the last, you know, 20 years, kind of capping out right around there, right? It was like Paul Turgot. Haile Gebrselassie. These are known amazing people. Bekele. And that's the threshold. Yeah, Bekele. Like, that's it, man. That's as high as we can go. And then all of a sudden, now we over-optimize. And that's what it is. It's a feat of over-optimization and amazing human ingenuity and engineering that then took this known quantity, this known person of known ability, and then able to catapult them almost like literally like a trampoline over Mount Everest. And while human nature, and what I love about running, is the transformation narrative. Everyone has a transformative story about running, whether, you know, it's losing weight, it's not being any good, being on the JV team and breaking 4 in college or fifth year senior. These capture our imagination and hearts and minds, and they are amazing narratives. But now we're getting into this kind of very gray area where we're getting fooled. And most people, as we saw with Steve and I's commentary and other people like Ross Tucker, Alex Hutchinson, like we can go on, like people who are in the sport day to day and know the limits and the difficulty of what this task is, starting to get backlash because you have to make a choice. People are very concrete emotionally and initially at a base level. We believe what we see. And then here come these quote unquote truth sayers, and we're out here saying, no, you got fooled. And people don't like to hear that because now you have to make a choice. And the choice is, do I continue to keep integrity with my own belief and interpretation of what I saw? Or do I choose to say I was wrong? And most people don't say I was wrong on this occasion. They anchor the emotion in that I am wrong as a human being. I'm wrong as I'm living. Every choice I'm making now is wrong because I can't trust myself. I can't trust what I see. By believing these truth sayers, quote unquote, who are out here telling you, no, this is what's really going on. You're being fooled. And Steve dealt with this. Kara Coucher dealt with this in the initial awareness about the performance enhancing operation at the Oregon Project. And I remember because I lived it with you and everyone's like, Steve, it's just like, Kara, sour grapes, she sucks. And like, credit to Kara for also like, and side note here, in 2016, calling it out at the Olympic trials when Amy Hastings or Shalane Flanagan had this shoe tech on their feet and Kara didn't. And Kara's right, it cost her an Olympic team. I don't know what the result is. I don't know who doesn't make the team. But it is such a powerful force multiplier that we have to understand that you can't now believe what you see, and you have to re-anchor your stasis about what is, what time is people are capable of with the enhancement of the shoe tech. Like I told all the people I coach, we have to treat it like a performance enhancing drug that's street legal right now. And if you legitimately don't apply it in your training and racing, you are self-handicapping yourself as long as it's not banned. That's how powerful it is.
I mean, it is. And I think, you covered a lot of ground there. And I think to kind of, narrow it down and what are you talking about is, because I got that backlash too on Twitter, not as much as you, but to agree.
Tanya didn't pick up your tweet, man.
Kenya found my tweet. And I love them, but
and I love Kenyans. They're such a beautiful people and they're so communal. And man, I've coached Kenyans and if you cross a Kenyan, watch out. Their grandmama's mama who has been the nicest person in the world will come out shaking her like broom ready to get you. And like that's what's amazing about their culture and people. So shout out to Kenya for being Kenya.
Yeah. So I think what we're trying to get at is no one is saying that this is the reason Kipchoge is fast or whatever. What we're trying to explain is how do you go from the standard of 203, 204, we'll say. And that was kind of the standard with, Gebre Selassie, Tergat, as you said, and then others who came after him, like Macau, Kipsang.
Yeah, Kiproto.
Yep. All those guys. Even Kipchoge himself was a, 204 type runner before the last couple years in this invention. And we're saying, okay, how do we make bridge that gap from 203, 204 down to 201, two hours, 159, 41, whatever it is, right?
Because that's also, sorry to interject, that's really hard to shave those seconds and minutes off when you start to get to that apex.
So let me give you an example of that. So if we say that Kipchoge, we'll just use round numbers, went from 203 flat down to sub 2, that's 3 minutes, right? The last time a marathon world record was improved by 3 minutes, well, the closest we can get, because it was the closest we can get, is 1967 when Derek Clayton beat the Japanese world record at the time, which was Morio Shigemitsu. It was a point-to-point course, so we'll ignore that one. But Abibi Bakela ran 2:12:11 at the Tokyo Olympics. So that was the official world record, we'll say.
Mm-hmm.
And then Derek Clayton, 3 years later, ran 209.36.
Deke, man. Love Deke.
So that's 2 hours and, what, quick math, 30-something seconds, right? Or 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
And, 2 minutes, sorry. 2 minutes.
Essentially half a mile, right? Yeah.
That does not even get quite to Kipchoge 203 flat, we'll say, down to sub to 159.40.
That's a kilometer. That's a K.
That is what we're getting at. And you have to remember, this was when Clayton beat Bakila's record. This was the infancy of marathoning, right? This is when we were transitioning from
the backwaters. New York City Marathon at the time was 26 laps around Yankee Stadium, 55 finishers in the first New York City Marathon. And that's all it was. It was this exhibition thing. Oh, yeah, you guys are just crazy.
Exactly. So you start thinking about that and you're like, gosh, like we have this historical data that shows that, you know, every time it's broken, which is every couple years, it's like a little chunk, little chunk, little chunk, little chunk, you know? I mean, it took them from 1981 when Rob de Castella ran 208.18, it took them until basically the year 2000 when Kenucci ran 205.42 to take 2 minutes and change off of it. So that was 20 years. And then to go from 205.42 down to, you know, 203-ish, which is, again, less than 3 minutes, you're looking at another 15 years, right? That's kind of what we're looking at, is we're asking the question of how did we jump 20 years into the future, you know?
Well, and it's not just, you know, Kipchoge. Like, here's the thing. It was like, I was totally on the other side of the fence. I was like, I've been burned by Nike marketing before, as we all had, right? Air bubbles didn't really work. Lunar foam was kind of a bust. The Nike shock technology didn't do anything. It was all just like neat marketing crap. And I was like, the 4%. I thought it was just, you know, again, using the heuristic of, you know, don't believe the marketing hype. Just another, you know, one of those efforts. And I believed it for a long time. And to my wife's credit, you know, she was looking around about, you know, late, about CIM 2018 and going, huh. A lot of girls and women who are, you know, kind of in my age group and maybe a little bit younger, who I am faster at every step of the way, faster on the track, beat them in road races. She's been in the injury cycle because of, an ankle thing for last year. She tripped on the sidewalk while running and, you know, busted her ankle. But so she hasn't been out competing actively, but the data points she had of years of competition against these people,
right,
you know, and beating them in cross country, in road races, in track, all of a sudden they're now catapulted to easily qualifying for the Olympic trials in the marathon, easily. Like, and my wife's only marathon that she completed was 2014. After 6 weeks after she made the U.S. championships in the 10,000, and she made the U.S. championships indoors in the 3K. So two-time qualifier to the U.S. champs, and she runs 250, albeit with a little bit of bonking. And, I mean, didn't make the trials for the 2016 cycle. But those people that even at her pinnacle she was just dusting all of a sudden got a lot better and now got to the trials. And you're like, wait a second. It is partly the commitment, the training. It is, yes. I'm not discrediting that. But there's a significant force multiplier because it's not just like one or two out of the cohort. It's like six or seven. And Steve and I know, Steve more than me, how hard the marathon is to train for and do. It's a tough nut.
The marathon has changed. And I think what you're seeing is because of this. I noticed this at CIM too because I was there.
I
had athletes competing. I was going all over the course, and everybody who's anybody was wearing the 4%. It was kind of hilarious watching the major packs trying to get the qualifiers. But that's what I noticed too, is people who, who had competed at against runners that I had coached and all this stuff, and I'd watched through the years come up through college and afterwards, who were very good runners, but all of a sudden they're dropping, you know, they're qualifying or they're dropping 2:15s, 2:14s, 2:13s when, you know, a couple years ago I would have been like, oh, that's a 2:19, 2:18. Yep. Or not even a couple years ago, before that race, I would have been like, oh, that's a 2:19, 2:18 type person based on their yeah. previous results. And same with on the women's side, it was like, okay, this is like a 2:35 type person, and now they're running 2:31, something like that. And you start scratching your head, and you're like, okay, is everyone just like all of a sudden figured out the marathon? or like, which is a tough thing.
Or is everyone on peds? Like, yeah. Is everyone on some kind of performance aid? Cause
right. And like, that's, and I think the best, you know, illustration, I did a little digging into this, is the Hansons brothers tweeted out that the Chicago Marathon, that was the first time in history that Americans had had 10 sub 212 guys in a single race. And, right. You know, I think we sit there and it's that is a perfect explanation, because I think 3-4 years ago, maybe we had one or two of those guys based on the historical data, but a lot of those guys would have been your 2:15 types, you know? Mm-hmm. And you're seeing this subtle shift in terms of performance based on these shoes, and then those who are catching up in other companies. And, you know, I went back and pulled the data so far on how many trials qualifiers we've had on the men's and women's for just the marathon. I'm ignoring
that was a good tweet. Yeah,
because the half standards changed, but the marathon standards stayed the same. And yes, some of this is due to better groups, people sticking around, all that good stuff, you know, but it's drastically changed. To hit the 2:19 or 2:45 standard in 2016, we had 86 men and 198 women. And for the 2020, so far, and this doesn't even include Chicago, so add another, you know, 10 to 15 on top of
that.
And
we haven't run the second CIM, or the last CIM. We haven't run New York. Right.
So 86 and 198 in 2016. 165 and 347 in 2020. Yeah. So we've already essentially on both sides, and the men already and the women are about to, doubled the qualifiers. And I'm not saying that it's all due to the shoes, but like the window.
No, a lot of it is due to shoes. I'm going to take that stance, because like there are not more groups. You know, like actually there's less groups if you look around at the ecosystem. When in 2015 and 16, you had a really robust ecosystem of sub-elite clubs. High Performance West was one, right? You had Hudson's group. You had Drew's group, NorCal Elite, right? Or NorCal Distance Project. There were a lot of these groups. The ecosystem changed, right? We lost funding with Skechers, you know, and people had to make life decisions and move on. Like other places, like even Roots Running was sponsored by 361, right? And then they pulled sponsorship. So they're actually, what's happened is the brands have consolidated their funding into a couple high level groups, and that's it. And so there is actually a less robust ecosystem right now, comparative to this time 4 years ago, of these post-collegiate sub-elite developmental clubs that exist. So now you have to say, okay, huh, because if there's less of that, and I mean, there's some strong pockets still, like Boulder's still a really strong pocket with, you know, a lot of athletes who come together and work out together. But you're even seeing it like with Tin Man, right? People are like, oh, why is, you know, people, you know, going in and out of Tin Man? Well, because there's no real actual funding dollars and people have to pay rent. And that's, it's just having lived that and tried to make one of those groups from scratch with zero budget or little budget, and then having Skechers come in and help sustain us for a year or two, it's a tough, tough environment, man, because there's not a whole lot of dollars out there unless you win. And so I'm going to say it is the shoes that is catapulting people forward, because here's why. I'll give a quick anecdote. on Sunday, I was out for a run on Leif Erikson in Portland. At the end of my run, there's a flat section on Leif before the, you know, it starts to go downhill towards the end. I ran 12 miles and I was going at a pretty good clip for me, 5:45 pace. I was in a groove. It was one of those runs where it's like, yeah, man, I feel awesome. You know, some guy comes up behind me and he's talking to me and he's chatting up and he's not breathing hard. And I actually look over and go, God, man, he's 50 pounds overweight. And this guy's flying with me. And I'm like, okay, hey, how you doing? Yeah, beautiful day. You know, just Portlanders being nice. And then after we kind of have our little dialogue for about a quarter mile, the guy just zips off. I'm like, how is this guy who's 50 pounds overweight crushing me? And then I look and go, oh, he's riding a bike. And the thing about riding a bike is it minimizes the cost of friction. It minimizes the wear and tear of the soft tissue. So you can go longer. You can go faster relative to running if you're on a bicycle. What those shoes do and what the shoe tech does with the foam and the carbon fiber plate, it allows you to go faster in workouts and longer in workouts with less wear and tear relative to if you had to do without it, because you have an extra propulsive aid that's helping spring your foot forward and working in concert with your body's normal stretch shortening spring cycle. So now I don't have as much wear and tear on the body. And if I don't have as much wear and tear on the body for, like, say, an 18-mile tempo run or 10 times a mile, I can go faster. And I can do more of it, and I can bounce back quicker between reps, because you're hearing runners now say, oh, my marathon buildup wasn't as hard. I don't feel as exhausted, right? Because they're in these shoes for those critical sessions. That has an impact. And that's why I told people we have to treat it like a performance-enhancing drug, because you know what you saw at the Oregon Project, like surreal things. This person did this insane workout. The next day they were able to, like, go for a 10-mile easy run at 6-minute pace, and they came back and did another surreal workout. It's not that dramatic, but there are those residuals, right? So, and I think we have to respect the residuals that this type of shoe tech allows in the training cycle.
So let's dive into this a little bit, because I think right now we've provided some data on progression. We've provided some anecdotes on experiences. You know, there's also been some good research on this by Roger Cram and his group. And Roger Cram, for those who don't know, is a biomechanist. He's highly respected, someone that I've studied for years. He did a lot of the work on determining what contributes to efficiency or economy. Some ingenious experiments where he would use pulleys and stuff and rubber bands to, you know, eliminate segments of the run or assist segments of the run, so he could determine what each contributed. When I was actually an undergrad, he came to speak at Houston, and so I've known him for a while and really respect his work and his lab's work.
Yeah, you his know, stuff's good.
They're obviously funded by Nike for this, so take that with what you will. But they've done some research on looking at the economy benefits and then the performance standard benefits, and then Ross Tucker put out a nice graph showing what the research says in terms of economy benefits, and then what that translates to performance, and then what that translates to time advantage in the marathon. And obviously, they're not testing a marathon in the lab, so there's some, you know, how this changes affects things, so there's some leeway. But the original 4% were named so because on average, they gave 4% boost in economy. If you look at the research data, a 4% boost in economy translates to a 2.6% performance benefit. Now, what in the hell is a 2.6 performance benefit? Think of it this way. Kipchoge's 159.40. If he got 2.6%, that becomes a 202.52. Okay, so 3 minutes and change. So that's massive, and that's the entire differential between Kometo's 202.57, essentially, and what Kipchoge ran. Now, the newest shoes with Kipchoge, the Next Percent plus the new shoes that have three carbon fiber plates and that stuff.
I call them Mars shoes. Yeah. You're on planet Mars. Gravity? No more.
So there we don't have the data all the data necessarily, but Ross Tucker plotted out and said, hey, if this gives you 5, 5.5, 6% benefit, then you're looking at a 159.40 being the equivalent to basically 204 to 204.30.
Yep.
So the data, the research points that we have points to a massive performance benefit. And I think the thing that we have to remember and that is lost sometimes in this original data is that there's also an individual response differential. So like anything, and probably right. depending on biomechanics, is mm-hmm. some will respond really well to it, and some won't respond that well to it. And the 4% mm-hmm. was an average. And, you know, from talking to insiders, there were some athletes who responded with 6-7% economy benefit, right. Which is, again, massive.
Huge.
But we sit there and we think, okay, for the prototypes, like, I have no doubt that those were customized for Kipchoge. His
foot, like, to make sure he responded to the 99th percentile.
And optimized to it. So when we sit here and we think, okay, we've got anecdotes, we've got some data on performance and changes, and we've got some research data, like, that satisfies whenever I look at things, and John knows this, I wrote about this in my book, Science of Running, is I look at three things. What does the research say, right? Mm-hmm. What does kind of history or experience tell us? And then what does the real world data kind of show us? And if we're mm-hmm. looking here, we have the research, we have the history and experience of, hey, this was normal and now this is what we're seeing. And we have the real world data on what runners are doing and what they're reporting. And I think that makes it, to me, where it's like, you know, it's easy to be like, oh, you're overblowing the shoes. And believe me, I'm not one who wants to hype up Nike's shoes.
No, nor I. I mean, we were both very reticent.
Yeah.
But the evidence is clear. Like, and it's an overwhelming majority of, you know, diverse evidence. And I think that's the key thing, is understanding we fundamentally, it's emotional initially because the stasis has shifted so drastically that now we're disoriented. In running, there's a, you know, Daniel's distance running formula is great because it gives people equivalencies of times, right, up and down the food chain of distances,
right.
or at least a ballpark. That's out the window now because the stasis is so radically shifted and so quickly overnight that no one can keep up. So this guy ran 210. Is he really a 210 runner? Well, I don't know. I don't, you know, I am inclined to question it and not discredit, but question it if the performance was done in the vape or in the next percents, because it's not the same 210 that it was 2 years ago, right? And this is the thing about inflation, is the purchasing power of inflation means the $10 that you had in 1990 that could buy you 20 Snickers bars today in almost 2020, 30 years later, only buys you 5, but it's still $10. I don't get it. Well, it's the purchasing power. So this is what's happening, is we're seeing an inflation of marathon and half marathon and 10K times. And then so now we need a quick heuristic, right, in this interim to figure out, okay, how to interpret this inflation. My quick heuristic is it's about a mile benefit in the marathon, you know, for the sub-elite category. When you get to the elite level, to optimize is much harder. And Kipchoge is kind of like, okay, it's about a K. What we saw with the women's world record in the marathon is like same situation. It's about maybe 1,200. These are the data points we have right now to create these, you know, quick and fast shortcuts and heuristics. But if I look at, say, okay, a woman ran like 232 in the next percents at Chicago, my heuristic is going to be, I'd bet she's probably about a 238, 239 type runner. But the nice thing is you can now go and look at trends and histories of performance of an athlete pre the intervention of this shoe, which is, you know, 2018 maybe, and then look at what that trajectory is. Because the thing about the marathon is, in order to run it fast, you have to have ran fast in other shorter distances prior to it. Every single person has done this at the elite level. There's been no one in the modern era, in the last 20 years, who has not ran lights out fast on the track, who didn't then wasn't able or who ran lights out fast in the marathon, who didn't first run lights out on the track. Samuel Njuro, remember, came to the marathon super young. But he ran the junior world record in the 10K, 26:40, right? And that's why he was so lights out quick. Now you're having people who are able to record a time that is lights out quick, you know, relative to our old anchor and our old stasis, who have zero performance indicators prior to that, that they're capable of that. And, you know, the reason people are unsponsored is because they don't have the credentials to get that sponsorship, because that's the way that game works is it's about projection and it's about predictability. And the sports marketing agents and agents heuristic is what you do as an NCAA athlete, you know, or are your times world class all of a sudden? And can you be competitive at the highest level? Now what's happening is we haven't recalibrated our stasis. And so now we look and go, oh my God, this person ran 230. Oh my God, this person ran, you know, 211. Oh my God. And they're not sponsored. They're a middle school teacher. Like Steve and I know what the life of an elite runner is. It's really freaking hard to run those times and living a normal life with the demands that we have in the modern era. But in, you know, when you have a boost and you recalibrate, you go, oh, okay, without the shoe tech, they're probably in this ballpark. And again, it doesn't take away from the fact they actually ran a marathon, they actually had to train, they actually had to have, you know, a intelligent buildup and fluid management. All these things still had to happen. It's just we are status-seeking creatures. And so now you have times that had been in the past difficult to attain, rarities. I mean, you got to also think there were coaches that we now know of who are using performance-enhancing aids with regularity who couldn't get highly talented athletes to run those times even before the the shoe tech. So I mean, and now you got, you know, this everyday man, the underdog, which is my favorite. And don't get me wrong, Steve and I, we love coaching the sub-elite underdog. I mean, like Roberta's a great story. And when Steve had both the top Americans at Boston a couple years ago who were everyday athletes, quote unquote, that's a great narrative. But now we're seeing them all of a sudden, they weren't able to dunk the basketball and the rim didn't change yet. The height of the rim is still 10 feet. We bring in shoe tech and now they can dunk a basketball, but you've never been able to dunk and you're getting older for some people and physiology doesn't change. As we get age, things start to slow down. But now what we're seeing is, you know, especially for people who are me and Steve's age, mid to late 30s, who we ran against in college whose butt we kicked in our 20s when we all had the most hormones in our bodies, they're now running, quote unquote, fast times or Olympic trial qualifying times in the marathon. And Steve and I are saying, like, huh? How? What? And it makes sense when you recalibrate and adjust for inflation and re-anchor your stasis.
Yeah, I think that's what we're getting at is there's a recalibration of the marathon going on from the highest level to the masses. I mean,
so, yeah, the masses. I mean, it's so quick.
Yeah,
it's overnight.
Boston qualifiers. I don't remember exactly, but I think they changed it by 5 minutes again for standards and. They've been changing it for years, but this is a pretty big jump. So you're seeing this altered status, and I think it's, you know, you made a good point there in that all that marathon progression that we talked about, how he chipped away from 209 to 208 to 206, 205, 204. You know, I don't know who was and who wasn't on that, but that took us through the EPO era.
It right? did, yes, it did.
and Even during that era, like, we weren't getting these types of gains.
Like, massive abuse and use of EPO.
Yeah, like before USADA and all WADA was established, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, which we know from cycling was a huge era, and I have little doubt that track was any different. So you're sitting there saying, okay, even that didn't give us the massive drops that we're seeing now. And, you know, granted that, you know, we can talk about pacing and all that stuff, but then you watch, you know, that was a nice argument and it no doubt helps to degree as well. But then you watch the women's world marathon or marathon gets smashed the next day, a record that has, right. You know, Paula Radcliffe.
That was very suspect, the record. Yeah. It was very, very suspect.
And, right.
I mean, and my first reaction wasn't like, oh, that person's probably on drugs. Because, like, Steve and I are in this, and we have a little bit more, you know, awareness about who's a red flag athlete and who's not. That was not my first suspect. I was like, oh, shit, those shoes really work.
Yeah. And it's...
that was my first reaction.
It's, you know, it's kind of mind-blowing to sit there and think, because Radcliffe's record was such an outlier. Even now, it's such an outlier. I mean, I think only one person... before this had been within like 2.5 minutes or some shit, you know? Mm-hmm. And now we have, I was looking at it the other day, I think that within 5 minutes of Koskaï, there's been maybe like 11 athletes, and the majority of them besides Paula have been within the last couple of years. So
yeah, but if you use the heuristic that's about, like, say for elite women marathoners, like at that level, I'm going with like about 1200 meters
yep.
advantage, 4 minutes, scale that back. Oh, that's without the shoes, that's a 218,
which is phenomenal,
which is still phenomenal. And that I can believe, right?
Right.
But it's like, because you have also these elite data points in close proximity with Bekele's near world record out of nowhere. Like there was no evidence.
Zero.
That Bekele was going to – everyone thought he was on the show. He's 37, you know. It's like – and Bekele is Bekele, you know. And I'm more inclined to believe, you know, that Bekele has demonstrated over the years his competency in being the world record holder in the 5 and the 10. Okay. But if it can make – and he's a more powerful runner. So the way some people's mechanics work is, you know, Bekele is a pusher. So he pushes with more power off the ground. That's why he was so good on the track relative to Kipchoge. Kipchoge is more finesse and more fluid, right? He's highly economical. But the Ethiopians tend to be more powerful in their stride and their force application, just how they are taught to run. And you start to see, oh, shit, like – my prediction is an Ethiopian will be the first national, entity to go under 2 flat and for the men, because there's just so many of them and they run with such power. And now you increase all of a sudden their economy over the marathon. That's why, like, you would see
right.
in the 5 and the 10 on the track that Kenyans struggled to keep pace once the Ethiopians figured out a powerful mechanic, right? And we have all these, the Dababa family, like, you know, Yomif, like all these Ethiopians who were starting to dominate and overseed the Kenyans in the 5 and the 10. And even we almost had it in the steeple, right? Cornelius had to just everything he had to not lose in Doha to an Ethiopian, because they figured out power. And Kenyans have always been very finesse. So that's why they still haven't been able to turn the switch, so to speak, in the marathon, because it's an economic thing. And the economy of the Kenyans is much greater than the Ethiopians. But now you give the Ethiopians, who are power runners, more economical way to transverse 26.2 miles. Dear goodness. And we haven't even talked about peripheral and central nervous system fatigue. You know, and that's the key thing, too, is like now the thing about increasing economy is you don't get as tired as soon.
Right.
And when that central nervous system fatigue sets in, it's exponential. Like when you bonk hard, and it's a hockey stick. It's an exponential curve. But now, because it's only peripheral fatigue, which is a lighter grade of fatigue, the brain is able to coordinate and keep those contractions going and keep the co-contractions from interfering with each other longer and more fluid. And that's, again, it's a force multiplier, because it's a positive feedback loop that keeps you going and going and going. So when fatigue hits, if it does, it's way later down the food chain of order of operations in a marathon. And because that's also factors into training. So, you know, everyone's like, oh, marathon training. I'm so tired. I'm so fatigued, because there's so much central nervous system fatigue, because you have to do all this volume at the elite level and even at the sub-elite level. And then you have to also do some quality. I mean, even if it's not everyday central nervous system fatigue, it's peripheral fatigue that's not fully regenerated from, which accumulates over the training block of like 20 weeks or whatever into some type of CNS fatigue. And why the taper is so important in a marathon because you're also having the brain bounce back and say, oh, thank God, I'm no longer like heavily exhausted anymore. And so part of it is like the neurology is you're feeling great on marathon day because you tapered for 2 weeks and finally like had an ability to go boop, reset. But now you have these enhanced physiological and morphological physical adaptations that allow you to, you know, run this distance. So that's why it's so multifactorial, because it's such an influencer, and it's not just day of performance. It is building up, and that's why we have to treat it as a PED that's street legal at the moment. And if you don't engage with it and use it in your own training, you are legitimately handicapping yourself.
Yeah, so let's circle back now. So we've kind of established, okay, the shoes work to a strong degree. They've changed the perception, and that's why, you know, that's why we're having this discussion or debate or whatever you want to call it. What do you think should be done? Because like I sit here and I think on the other side, whenever I have mentioned the shoes, people are like, oh, technology and progress. Like why limit it? But then, you know, my retort is always that like in every sport, they have technology and progress, but it's regulated so that when the athletes line up, it's not technology that is determining.
Yes, right.
The
outcome.
Outcome, right? So,
and you have this in Formula One, right? In Formula One, they're always pushing the envelope to make the newest, latest tech. And then Formula One, the governing body is always outlawing it because it's, you know, it's how fast and efficient can those Formula One cars go? But they have a safety threshold, and the tolerance of safety is I can't put a human being who's trying to competitively race in a zero-sum game in a car that's going 300 miles an hour if the safety precautions aren't here. Like if you can't go 300 mile crash into a wall, they're not going to let you do it because you're going to you run the risk of killing the human being. Right. So they're constantly, you know, progress outlaw. I, for one, am like, yeah, by all means, the shoes are awesome. Everyone should wear them. Let's go, you know, because it's fun to go fast. Like, I think that's great. But Steve's right. You can't have this special, game-changing footwear tech with three carbon fiber plates and springs in it, this, you know, next percent, you know, infinity percent foam that has this amazing return only for one person, only for a handful of your people when we have the Olympic trials coming up and it's a quote-unquote self-selection race where the athletes compete. Like, so now you've aided someone and you've handicapped everyone else. We can't have that. So there needs to be some type of regulation saying, if you're going to make this tech, there'd be no patents on it.
Yes.
Any footwear company can make it. Here it is. It's for everybody. The playing field's level. You can choose not to use it. Like, you can choose not to do long runs. You can choose that for a marathon. That's fine. You can train however you want. But it's here and available freely for everyone to use if you so desire.
So that's a big question, that's the big point I think that you made that I wanted to make as well, because, you know, some people have been like, well, it's some of this is available because, you know, anybody can spend $250 and buy it. So what's the deal? And I think that point, there's two counters to that, is that one is that prototypes happen, right? And that they're not available to all. And then the argument is, well, everybody does prototypes. That's true. But I think what you have here is the second part is patents and stuff like that make it where companies can't have the same effects because of, you know, laws and patents and all that stuff. So they have to get as creative as possible to get as close as possible. And I think that creates this situation where we have this unfair playing field, and then you have sponsors and all that stuff where certain athletes can wear certain things. And if, you know, athletes will, if you're, then you have the sponsor determining the race outcome, which is something I don't think that we want. And then you might even eliminate some sponsors who are like, well, we're not going to play this game because we can't, from, right. a legal standpoint. So I think that's a good suggestion in the sense that regulation needs to occur so that there's at least some sort of level playing field as close as we can get it while still allowing innovation, but that innovation needs to be available for, you know, every athlete to be able to choose, and whether they use it or not is up to them, but it needs to be freely available. And you see that, you know, you see that in swimming, they banned those laser suits because one company had them and others couldn't use it. So it created unfair advantage, and athletes who weren't sponsored by them were rightfully upset. I remember Michael Phelps, you know, made a big statement from a fair play standpoint at that point. And other, you see the same thing in other things, you know, golf clubs, like all sorts of innovation, but they have to be within a very specific window of, hey, the head of the golf club can only be this size and no larger, and like this shape, and the length can only be this, right? There's regulations. Same with baseball bats. You know, there's a reason we don't use metal bats or even corked bats.
Mm-hmm.
Tennis rackets. Like, everything has allows innovation within this window. And I think track, for too long, we've just said, you know, it doesn't matter too much. Like, just do it. And for the most part, we've gotten away with it because, well, shoes have changed over the last 50 years. There has been no significant leap that is at this level. We're talking fractions of a percent, maybe mere seconds here and there, based mostly on weight, on how light you could get the shoe.
Yes, that was the arms race, was a weight game.
Which everybody, there's no super technology. Everybody could play that game. The foam and stuff like that, up until a couple years ago, didn't really play that difference. Even the Adidas Boost foam, which was hyped to death, gave less than, on the research, less than 1% of an economy boost, which is within the margin of error for the testing of that stuff.
Yes, it's negligible. It's like when Nike put a carbon fiber plate in the Zoom Victories. Like, they did that in 2012, I believe.
Yes.
And they didn't tell anyone because they just put it on their athletes. But it didn't have such an overwhelming impact. So, again, it's, I understand you're in a competitive economy, and that's the excitement of innovation is, okay, we're trying to compete to win and to ensure, or at least give a higher probability for victory. But Steve's 100% right. When it becomes a clearly unlevel playing field, that's when you need to step up and blow the whistle. It really is no different than, you know, Steve and Kara's and everyone else's efforts to, you know, blow the whistle and report what they saw with the Oregon Project. It creates a distortion about what is normalcy, and it also makes it completely unfair. And I mean, you know, now that we can finally talk about it freely because the ban has been placed and the evidence is out there in the public, you know, for years people had to sit and just kind of take that punishment, and careers were lost, you know, and talent was compromised and spat out the sport really quick because you had people doing the impossible, which is getting faster as they got older, being able to, you know, from the 1500 to the half marathon, run near world record or near top or top five all-time marks, which physiologically you can't train that energy system to be able to swing that Y with that degree of variance within one season. Steve and I know this. We've watched this at all these levels, but it distorts. And like we said before, we're mostly concrete people, and we have to believe what we see. And, you know, for years, people were like, oh, no, they're all good. It's amazing. They're superhumans. Like, I remind, like, you know, I beat one of their stars at high school, outsprinted the kid. I beat him. And I'm not good, you know, but it's like, and this person went on to be very, very good, amazingly good, the best ever good, right? And you're like, huh, how? And people in the know who have a lot of anecdotal data points, like Steve and I, we, you know, start scratching our heads. And the prototype thing is huge because, you know, there's Nike employees who I know who are solid runners, and then they start running world-class times. And Steve and I have coached, you know, women who, you know, oh, it's so hard to get them to run 32 minutes on the track, altitude, you know, every type of legal performance, you know, enhancing aid that anyone can go do. and all this build up just to run like 32 flat. And then someone who's like, oh yeah, I'm just going to work full time and no big deal and go and, you know, show up in these shoes and I'll run a world-class time being a full-time employee at a company and not really having a full-time commitment to training. You're like, whoa, timeout, James. Because then that distorts not only the decision maker's point of view, it distorts the coach's point of view, the athlete's point of view. And the thing with these shoes is if you don't readjust your stasis, you're going to believe that this guy or gal is actually a legitimate street legal 210, 230 runner. And then you're going to go back into training and train them like that. But what's going to, my projection is what's going to happen if people take that point of view, they're actually going to get that person hurt because now they're training beyond the reality of their physiology. So you have to recalibrate and go, well, physiologically speaking, their threshold of work and intensity is actually step back about a mile, right, for over the marathon. And that's the more appropriate threshold to train in day in and day out. Otherwise, you're going to have so many frustrated athletes and coaches who are going to get themselves hurt or not see the big boost or jump in time the next marathon around and go, what am I doing wrong? Why is it so? Because it's really addicting to get like a 7 minute or 8 minute PR in the marathon and like put yourself from sub elite into also all of a sudden national class level. Like that's exciting, man. I want that too. That's so much fun. But we as coaches, and this is important. This is why Steve and I are out here, you know, waving the flag and sounding the alarm bell, go, guys, hold on, ladies, hold on. Like, we got to do our due diligence and, you know, in reflection of the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm by saying we can't train these people who have ran this time in these shoes at that level because their physiology is not really there. It's in the ballpark, but we can't go, okay, you're 230 now. Now we're going to train you to run 224 or, you know, or 225 level. It's going to be too much and they're going to break. Even the footwear, you know, tech can't protect people from overtraining syndrome, you know, or overreaching syndrome, which could be a possible residual effect in the next year from all these watershed PRs that are happening in these marathons and half marathons.
Yeah, that's a really good point because it, you know, I think that's the biggest lesson, biggest takeaway from this is, you know, we'll see what the IAAF does in terms of rules, but there does need to be this recalibration of
stasis. Yeah.
Yeah, what it means to run 210 or 230 on the men's and women's side, and then also what it means from a training standpoint is in the past, you know, and I've coached a slew of 230 type marathon girls.
That's kind
of
like your niche, you know.
Yeah, that's my MO, man. I got 230, but I will point out that Lindsay Flanagan ran 228 oh something, and she was the only person. She made this choice, you know. I leave it up to them. She was the only person in that I want to say top 15, and definitely all the top Americans who did not wear a carbon fiber shoe. So
I was impressive.
I was like, Lindsay, you know, that's probably like a 225, 226 if you didn't, you know. But we'll have that discussion later, but it's up to her. But you know, I as I said, I've coached a bunch of 230 type women and it really is readjusting their perspective. And we've talked a lot about the Nike shoe, but other shoes that just don't have the data, but they're starting, you know, ASICS and Hoka and all these.
And Brooks has one. I mean, it's adapt or die right now. Like that's what it is. When it's unregulated, it's adapt or die. So right. Everyone has to adapt because if not, you're handicapped.
So we're focused on this, but we just don't know the data on the other shoes. And presumably their labs are looking at it and trying to match as best they can. But I think that's why you're seeing this whole shift here. And as I was saying, 230 used to mean X for me, but now it means Y. And the training, you know, when I had someone who could run 230, the training is really tough.
It is. It's brutal.
But I just think here now, and you know, if I was to have someone who did that and then ran 226, we'll say, is the training to run 226 is even more brutal, and I can definitely. I mean, I'll put it this way. I went through all of that training when I was with Kara Goucher when she ran 225 at Boston after her pregnancy. I believe it was 225. But I was her training partner.
Yeah, you were her pacer donkey. Yeah.
And I was, you know, just for the record, this was pre-carnitine infusion, Steve. But
when normal Steve, yes.
Yeah, normal Steve. But I was in a phenomenal shape. I mean, I was looking at my training logs for some records based on that. But I remember doing 3x mile where I went like 4:30, 4:30, 4:18.
You guys did that like 10x mile workout.
Yeah.
You put up a couple years right. on workout a day, you know, series.
So, like, I was in really good shape, you know, individually. And then training with Kara, we did this 10x mile at 5-minute pace on the roads, on the hills. And, I mean, it was tough for me. So I know what kind of training it takes to get there. And I think now we're having this shift that I think just needs appreciation and understanding and recalibration for athletes and coaches of what it means to train for and run 225 or, you know, 210 or whatever has it.
Yeah, and I think there's no hate or bitterness. Like, innovation's fun. This is so rapid. It's a watershed moment, and it's an important moment in, you know, our time in the distance running and, you know, endurance competitive space. And that's why Steve and I like got up, you know, on our high horses and put ourselves out there and said, hey guys, actually we need to think about this a little bit more in depth and critically, and why we, you know, got on this and made this podcast ASAP, because, you know, I want to see people run fast. Like, this is why High Performance West exists now, is to help coaches and athletes get better. And this is awesome. And it'd be great to have, you know, 50 American men running sub 210. And it'd be great to have, you know, 50 American women running sub 225. Like, that'd be a lot of fun. But it's with the, you know, understanding that it's not the sub 210 or sub 225 that was your mother's or father's era, right? It's just the era shift. Like in bike and cycling, right? Aero bars make people faster in time trials, right? Carbon fiber frames, you know, are lighter. Like, I mean, the shoe tech is there. Like, even in cycling too, like the clip-in pedals are, you know, have full length carbon fiber versus when they're flimsy rubber, right? When Eddie Merckx was, you know, in dominance in Tour de France. Like, that's all in good. It doesn't take away from the, you know, the real spirit about what competitive regulation distances are, which is competition against each other, competition against humans versus humans. We kind of get distracted by the status of the clock and go, oh, look, I ran this esteemed time. Well, it might not be as esteemed as it once was because, you know, things got better, but more importantly, very critical things got significantly better. It's kind of how like the sub 4-minute mile for men isn't quite that crazy of a feat anymore. And you have people going to, you know, Boston University or other indoor tracks where that's tech. The indoor track at Boston is tech. The indoor track at Iowa or UW is tech. 300 meters, no wind, you know, very little wind resistance, air conditioned, perfect conditions. College kids who are going out, you know, every weekend, are able to, you know, get in a race and run sub 4 and never repeat it outdoors, and sometimes not even make the NCAA championship meet. I'm a sub 4-minute mile, I can't even make in the championship, right? It doesn't take away from the fact that they ran this time, but it's not about the time. At the end of the day, we got to remember that. It's about competition against your peers in your generation, your age group. And so now we can thankfully use kind of a historical abacus here to calculate, okay, how does this time in this era stack up to this time in this era? And across the board in running, it's being very similar. But now that's no longer the case. Now it's like pre-cinders on the track, and everyone has a debate. It's like, oh man, how fast did Jim Ryan really run the mile because he did in cinders versus synthetic tracks? Now we have pre, you know, shoe tech, you know, era. And unless there's some regulation that happens, we'll have this post shoe tech era and we'll calibrate to a new normal, but we can't necessarily compare what happened in the marathon times ran in the early 2000s to this point in time moving forward unless there is some type of honing in of this tech.
Exactly. I think that's kind of the big MO is that there's it's two different eras, like the cinder and synthetic, and
which is fine. It's fine. But innovation's fun, but we can't.
And I think the key there is that when we went from cinder to synthetic, the key was we made technological innovations, which helped times, but it was across the board.
Everyone had access to it. Everyone, like Mondo tracks are better than other types of tracks, right? A lot of world records are set on Mondo, but you can go, but everyone gets to compete on the Mondo track.
Right.
Not, hey, only my athletes with this brand compete on the Mondo track, and you all have to compete on the more bouncy, slower track, and then we'll all mail the times in and see, you know, who's the winner. No. Everyone had the playing field from an external standpoint. The external conditions was level. Right now, the playing field with externally, what shoes you choose to wear outside your physiology, outside who you are, that's not level. And it's demonstrated it's not level, and that's why it's a big deal right now.
Yes, exactly. So I think we'll wrap it up with that thought, because I think that is the key. And again, just to be clear for all our fans in Kenya, we are not discounting Kipchoge's effort.
We love Kipchoge. No human is limited. Yes. We love you.
He's really the perfect person to do this as well. So it's amazing achievements. He's undoubtedly, what's more impressive to me than the sub two is that he's nailed every single marathon, which is, as coaches we know, is so, so difficult to do.
Respect
to him. But we have to, we're not anti-tech either. As John said, we love innovation and tech, but we need to do the deep work to understand what we want sport to be and not just be like, we'll just, not have any regulations or not have any understanding at all. Kind of this laissez-faire approach. I think it's important, just like every other sport, to take the time to think about what we want it to be and how we want to make sure that the sponsorship isn't determining the winner.
But in the meantime, load up on the shoe tech, go have fun, go run fast. Because, again, it might not be around much longer. And I know, like, I bought Next Percents, and they're a lot of fun. So have fun.